welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 352. My name is Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have someone back on the show who's been on a couple times from Exos, formerly Athletes Performance, doing amazing stuff over there, and he just finished school. That's Nick Winkelman. Nick, what's up?
Kevin, it's great to be back on, my man.
Okay, so we have a ton of stuff to talk about, but I think for you, it must feel like you just finished a marathon, because not did you just finish more schooling, you also just finished the gauntlet of the Perform Better Summit summer schedule.
Yeah, you know, June and July was incredible because I had my son about 7 weeks ago. Wow. So obviously that's been a massive addition to the family, and he's just the joy of our life. And adding him now to our 4.5-year-old, they're just two battery packs together. In 1 month, you're not kidding. I had to pass two exams. I had to propose my research to my professors. I then had to submit an IRB, which is basically I have to make sure that the actual universities involved think that everything I'm doing is ethical. That had to get accepted all the way to fly to Southern Methodist University to do the research to 48 hours later finish up at Long Beach. So it's been a wild ride, and now the sight line is there to finish up in December. So,
well, let me ask you like somewhat of a loaded question.
Sure.
And I'm sure you've gotten this a lot. I remember we were talking back in God, it was March in Boston, and like you got to Boston to get ready to speak at the one day Perform Better, and like before you're speaking, you were doing homework on your laptop before you're going to speak, and I'm like, Nick, how are you doing this stuff with a family and everything else that you do? How are you keeping this all together without just like going off the deep end?
Oh my goodness. Well, I think, when I look at it, when I started the program 4 years ago, I had every minute of my morning and my night completely calibrated. And about 2 years into this, it just became chaos. And I'm not kidding. It was midnight. I landed from a flight coming from east to west, and I realized that I hadn't done a forum post. And I'm literally got like 5 minutes to go before this thing's supposed to be due. And I'm typing it on my iPhone, literally squinching my eyes, making sure I can even get to any kind of grammar in there. But yeah, man, it's been a wild ride. But once you get deep enough into it, you just want to get over the finish line. I'm like, some people want to climb Everest. For me, I'm just calling this, it's an academic Everest. I just wanted to finish the journey. So
please tell me you've gotten a vacation in.
I'm actually going home next Wednesday, and my wife and kids have already been out in Oregon. We're heading out there and going to spend a week on the Oregon coast, which for me just is the absolute best place to decompress and knock out a couple books and hang out with the family.
So what are you finishing up right now? You're finishing up some testing, some research?
Yeah, so I did my second round of data collection. So last year we took elite soccer players, call them elite Division I male soccer players, through a series of sprint repetitions under different cues, right? Mm-hmm. And then this year we did the exact same study, but with elite sprinters. And actually, I'm really proud of this. We had the average woman in the study, she was running under 12 seconds for the 100 meter. And then our average male times were under 11 seconds. Mm-hmm. So, when you read research, sometimes they say elite, and we're talking like a Division II football player, for our sprint study, these are actually truly elite individuals. So I can't give out too much information, but what's exciting about it is the paper that I'll submit for publication and will be the focus of the dissertation is actually going to be able to put a pretty high definition statement out there on how we should best cue those that are moderately skilled at a task versus how we should best cue someone that's elite at a task, and then use the literature to point to how we should best cue someone that's a novice. And funny enough, I think someone on Twitter asked that as one of their questions.
Yeah.
Would you cue someone 18 and under different than someone maybe that's a little bit older? And if we get to that, there's definitely some science that points to some answers there, which is quite interesting. You always want to, they tell you not to solve the world's problems with your dissertation, but it's always fun to come up with something new and novel to make people better.
No, we're definitely getting hit on that because, like I mentioned a bunch of times on the show, like that's the population that I'm training most of these days is the middle school athlete.
Yeah.
Those people that are really experiencing this whole concept of strength and conditioning for the very first time,
yeah,
and trying to understand this stuff. So, with all that research, now that you're finishing up, how long does it take to now get that out to the public and get it like in a package that people are going to be able to digest?
Oh man, that's a really good question. So right now, my goal is to submit three things out of the actual dissertation. So I have two different literature reviews. One's going to be a general literature review discussing attentional focus and cueing. So basically, it's going to look at internal cues, external cues, and really saying nothing, right, from what they call a control condition, and look at that, how it affects, you know, sprinting and jumping and change of direction. So I'm simply recontextualizing it to sports performance. My second lit review is what I find the more interesting of the two. It's the one that looks at level of expertise as a mediating factor in cueing. Mm-hmm. So basically what we're looking at in that review is, okay, if you have a novice who's doing something for the first time versus someone that's an expert, how should you best cue them from, you know, should you give them an external cue? Should you say nothing? Should you just let them perform the task? And then a second layer to that, Kevin, which is quite interesting, is it also might depend on the task itself. So are you doing something that happens just in an instant, like hitting a golf ball or jumping? Or are you doing something that's more continuous, like sprinting or swimming, or even you consider repetitions on a bench press or a squat, a continuous type activity? So that lit review, I think, should provide some very powerful, just simple recommendations on how cueing changes as people learn, which is awesome. Because now, again, it's not just an art. There's some science to it. And then the paper itself will, again, look at moderately trained to elite trained sprinters and the influence of internal, external, and non-focus or control condition cues. I will submit all of those within the next 6 months. Mm-hmm. So you're probably looking at those hitting the market at the end of next year, mid to end. That's how long it's going to take, unfortunately. Obviously, I'm going to be doing blog posts and presenting on this stuff, mm-hmm. you know, throughout next year's conference season. And in doing so, what's quite interesting, you ask about access. And this has become a huge interest of mine. Right now, the level of access to research for our training community is so small. Mm-hmm. If you go on Google Scholar, you know, you can probably get access to a small percentage of the actual research papers that are out there outside of reading the abstract.
Right.
So funny enough, almost every journal right now is giving you a pay-to-play option, meaning – and I'm being serious with these numbers, upwards of $1,000 I can pay as the author and they'll make the article free, meaning anybody can access it versus just the universities that have the license to the actual journal. So I'm really contemplating for at least some of them to pay to make them free so I can legally share them with the world.
Interesting.
Huh. Yeah. Yeah. And I should be having, hopefully knock on wood, the book that people have been asking me about, my goal would be to start having a manuscript framed up and submitted next year. So hopefully a lot of stuff in the next 18 months.
Good. That was my next question. It was like, because I, you know, I'm all for, you know, getting the research papers out. But, you know, I open up, and this is why I'm a big proponent of like Alan Aragon's research review, where he can go in and like look at the research and then digest it for me and like yes. a great, you know, mother bird regurgitate it so I can actually understand what the hell is going on in this research from someone that understands it way better than I ever will. So I'm looking forward to that kind of I guess more like that general population product.
Absolutely.
So I can understand it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be had in that area, and I'm excited to put forth something. So yeah.
That's funny that you mentioned that you could potentially now spend money to make research public. And I know that like this is way off topic, but you know, we've always heard in the past like supplement companies like paying to get research done and then having some of that research be somewhat biased. If this is something that like the supplement companies would use down the road to make sure that, you know, their research that it says their supplement or whatever they're trying to promote is going to be great, make that a little bit more public by just putting the money up front. Hopefully that doesn't make things weird for research and in the market. I don't know anything about this. So,
well, you know, it's quite interesting, Kevin. And just to give you an anecdote, I cannot tell you, I'll give you a very specific example. So most people probably listening are familiar with the book Drive mm-hmm. by Daniel Pink. Okay. And Drive, if you are into kind of motivation theory, is completely based on a topic that I've done some presenting on called self-determination theory, which mm-hmm. really just reinforces you need autonomy in that process. You need to feel that you're a part of this process you're walking down. You don't want to just purely be led. In doing so, the authors that came up with that are Dr. Ryan and DC, and some of their research dates back to the 1950s. So one day I called Dr. DC up. We aligned a call because I wanted to ask him about motivation and a number of things that I was working on. And great conversation. Just the wealth of knowledge and contribution is just amazing by this one individual. And funny enough, I asked him about the book Drive. I'm like, you know that Daniel Pink wrote an entire book that's been on the New York Times bestseller, one of the best TED Talks ever. He's likely made millions of dollars off your theories. And I'm like, did you ever engage with him? Did he talk to you? He's like, yes. He came out here for, you know, a couple hours. We had a chat. And then obviously Daniel read all of his research, I'm assuming, to write the book and do his research and build the context. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, I'm like, you know, I didn't ask him, did it bother him? But I kind of asked him, you know, does that bug you that someone else took all of your theories and just completely recontextualized them and made all this money? And for him, it was incredible because I've had this conversation with countless researchers and he really didn't mind. He felt his job, his only job, is to do the research, mm-hmm. to come up with the evidence. It's everyone else's job to go fishing and searching through the evidence that he puts out there and make it practical. And I think that's what's important to understand is the researchers, when they're doing this, their passion is in the lab. Their mm-hmm. passion is bringing out this information. It is really our job as the practitioners to get in there and be, you know, what I like to call translational. Mm-hmm. And whether I can't remember the guy you just mentioned or Brett Contreras and his colleague who's kind of reading the research right. and summarizing it, I think more of that is needed really to bring our field to the next level, because the researchers by themselves, they're good intentioned, but at the end of the day, they're not going to be doing the practical translation for us.
Right. Yeah. Like for me, it's like an archaeologist, you know, discovering some Latin texts that are the lessons of the universe, but I can't understand it unless someone is there to translate it for me, because yeah. I do not read Latin. not yet, at least. I'm still working yeah. on Japanese these days. So
nice.
So that's an interesting start to the show. This is super fascinating stuff. I promise we're going to get to some of the questions from the audience. I definitely want to hit on you know, what you guys are up to at Exos too, because you're obviously constantly having athletes come in there. You got so how many athletes did you have at the NFL Combine this year?
This year we had 120 total athletes prepping for Combine and or Pro Day. I want to say we had between 80 and 100 of them actually were invitees to the Combine. So we had just under 30% of the entire Combine trained at an Exos facility.
Wow. That's if you really just turned on like the NFL Combine stuff, I'm sure you saw a lot of the Exos athletes there. And you guys also have like a prep room. Like, I'm always just super impressed. And like, I could even like go into like a half an hour talk about just like Mark Verstegen's talk about what you guys did for the German national soccer team. and just like what you guys do in terms of like prep and just putting people in the best possible situations for success. Man, I feel like that's like a whole different discussion. I'm almost worried to go into that side of that topic because I think we're going to go down a rabbit hole there. But just, you know, make sure that if you're listening to this, you know, check out what Exos is doing and make sure that you're following them on like Twitter and stuff like that, just because they're doing really cool stuff. And not only that, but like the performance specialist certification stuff that they got. I was talking with Brett a couple episodes ago about the stuff that you guys are doing with the military and armed services, and also the tactical training, you know,
yep.
stuff that you guys are doing. If you are like a personal trainer or strength coach and you want to get an idea of what they are doing to Exos, you guys offer that education as well. You guys have just put together incredible, you know, systems of education for people out there. And that's something we talked a little bit off there, is like just the unbelievable need for improving the education of I would even just say like health professionals out there, not just personal trainers and strength coaches, but everyone out there that are, you know, in the job and in the industry of helping other people, because there is still so little regulation these days.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, one thing that Exos is trying to do, and obviously, you know, you guys are doing with Mike, is trying to put out a systems-based approach that is evidence-based. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about it, with every education course we offer, whether it's online or on-site, and the big thing that I try to put forth to individuals is, while we are going to teach you methods, we're going to teach you best practices, we're going to teach you how we, you know, upgrade strength and power in the weight room, we're going to teach you how we develop sprinting capacities on the field and energy system development and everything in between. We're going to show you what we know today, right, as Mike mm-hmm. would say. But the most important takeaway that I encourage people to focus on, especially when they're going through our XPS certification or Exos Performance Specialist certification, is that I want you to look at every component. Look at how one component builds into the next. And the best way to think of it is like a bunch of dresser drawers, right? Each one has a very specific purpose. Mm-hmm. And no one of them can explain the whole, yet you need all of them to effectively develop your client and effectively develop your athletes. So if we understand systems and framework, and that is our approach to education, you know, then if someone says, well, I have this whole concept of pillar preparation, and pillar preparation within my methodology is meant for injury prevention, and I now know I do three things. I do some level of self-massage, active stretch, and some kind of activation or corrective exercise. Now, if I go to a conference and I hear Gray Cook talk about a great new corrective exercise, I now can go back to my training system and ask a simple question. Is this new method going to make me better? Mm. Is it going to make me worse? Or is it going to make no change? Well, let's assume if it's Gray Cook, it's not going to make you worse, right? So then you have to evaluate, is this any better than what I'm currently doing? If it is, then you have to ask a follow-up question. Is it operationally efficient? Can I integrate it in, or do I need some kind of expensive piece of equipment? And is it interesting for my clients or my athletes? Mm-hmm. If it's better and operationally efficient, now you have an upgrade. Now you've been able to take that thing from that conference and upgrade the pillar preparation aspect of your system. Similarly, maybe you look at it and say, well, you know, Gray Cook's got a lot of great stuff. This is equally good to what I'm already doing. Fantastic. Again, ask the two questions. Is it operationally efficient? Is it interesting for my clients? If the answer is yes, then awesome. Now you have a new tool that you can rotate in your catalog of corrective exercises. Mm-hmm. The only way you can be systematic in going to a conference and reading books and reading literature is if you have a system with which all of that new information coming at you can exist, and you have that process of, does it make me better? No change, or worse, and having those follow-up questions to make sure it is efficient within your operations, and your clients are going to like it.
That's such a great way to put it, because I've been thinking about this a lot lately. There's a really great book, Essentialism. Like the way that I was trying to like think about those concepts of like making sure, you know, if you are building, and this is great for like, if you're listening, if you're a personal trainer or strength coach, or if you're just like the you know, the person that just really is into this stuff and wants to do their own programming, it's making sure that you have a reason for why you're doing every single thing in that program. And if you make some changes, you got to be really considerate of like, yeah, that means I'm going to be doing something. I'm going to have to take something out. I can't just keep adding on to that, you know, pile. There's only so much water that you can put into that glass. But the way you put it is just awesome. Yeah, super fascinating stuff. And make sure that you just don't go to these like summits or these seminars and just say, oh, I should just do everything that they just said. Don't just throw out everything that you just did. You know, make sure that you kind of reflect on what you're currently doing and make an assessment based off of all that stuff. But I don't know, do you see that a lot? Like when people come to your practicals and your hands-on, do people come up and say like, yeah, I have to throw everything out? Do you ever get concerned when people come up and say like, I'm just going to just throw out everything I was doing and now I'm just going to do exactly what was in your talk?
Yeah, no, I think I hear that less. I definitely heard that countless times. You have the person comes up, you know, handshake, high five, says, that was amazing. Now I've got to go back and completely change everything that I do. And I absolutely, you know, I hate hearing that because I don't want that to happen for all the reasons that we just discussed. So I'll usually spend more time with those individuals actually just to get a better understanding of what their current state is. But at the same time, if you're dealing with a new personal trainer or a new coach that doesn't yet have a vetted system, I could see how that is the first thing that perceptually pops into their mind. But with that, funny enough, Kevin, what I try to do, whether I'm giving a presentation or I'm giving a practical, I always try to contextualize it to tell them, hey, this is the world that we're going to live in for the next 90 minutes. If you live in this world over here, it might be slightly different for you, which means you need to ask a question when we get to an aspect of the presentation that doesn't seem to align with what you currently do and who you currently support. That at least frames up, right, and puts everyone on the same level and kind of meets them where they're at. At the same time, I always try to come at things from a framework perspective or a system perspective. I would hate that any of my practicals just looks like all these drills are thrown together and it's an amazing experience in the session, but something that people feel that they can't take back with them. So as I like to say, you have to give them the fish, but I will always maybe be a little bit more theoretical or spend a little bit more time contextualizing in my presentation and practicals just to make sure they also know how to extract the fishing pole. So this year alone, I spent 10 minutes discussing the two major frameworks that I was going to bring forth during my sprint practical of Perform Better. I said, hey, as I'm teaching these drills, notice we're going to be filtering them based on posture, leg action, and arm action. All the while, I want you to notice how the drills sequence together to drive implicit or nonverbal, just learning through experience. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I want you to listen how I provide external cues and analogies to guide and orient that person with their intent relative to the skills I'm teaching. And what's really cool in that session is everyone that did not actually go through it, I asked them to pick one of the participants and watch them the entire time. Right. So they could be pressure testing these ideas and watching how they're applying to that athlete or client as if it were their own. And then similarly, I asked the people going through it to be like athletes. We did a pretest on an empty mind, if you would, had them go through the session, then did a post-test, and I'd ask them to reflect at the end. So now it's kind of like we had people in the audience talking about coaching and what they saw, people in the actual group telling us what they felt, and all the while, people had the framework and the lens to extract the right things from that, so it wasn't just 90 or hour and 15 of Nick's top 20 sprint drills. And I think that's critical to being a great educator. You're trying to, from an instructional design standpoint, set your audience up for success in getting the most out of what you're talking about.
I unfortunately, this is an audio podcast, but I got to experience your practical. I got to kind of in between working at the booth, got to head over and watch your practical a couple times at multiple summits throughout the summer. And magic, because you got to keep in mind, like the Perform Better summits, when people go to these, like these are first off, they're the people in the industry that are already setting aside time to go to these events. So they're putting in money and time. So they are part of like an elite group of this industry. But still, with that being said, you go to some of these hands-ons and it's kind of rough in terms of how people move. So when I walked into your room and you had like 200 people going through these drills, like perfectly, I'm like, holy shit. Like sometimes to get people to skip getting adults to skip, they completely forget that like you turn 18 and like the skipping gene just like disintegrates. Yeah. So having you just like get these like people in their 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s, like going and like doing skippings, I was like literally up against the wall, like with my jaw open. I'm like, all right, we got something here, because this is like still something that we fight with, because we want, like at MBSC, like we obviously have our athletes doing the skipping, but it's something that we want to instill in our adults as well, just in terms of like great movement. So how do you approach this stuff? Like how do you do it?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's a great question, because it's funny. I've done, lucky enough to do countless seminars, private and public at the Perform Better and whatnot. And I can't tell you how many people come up and they have that same sentiment, Kevin, that they're basically like, I can't do this. And I'm like, well, why not? They're like, well, my clients aren't going to be able to skip. And I'm like, well, have you ever tried to teach them how to skip? Right. No, they can't do it. And I'm like, I mean, day one, when they show up, frankly, they can't do a whole heck of a lot of what you're going to ask them to do and inevitably put in. And again, I think it's one of those things that people shy away from what they personally can't do and what they personally haven't been exposed to. So that's one natural constraint in our industry. And again, I think that's why we're moving away from the term strength and conditioning, to, as we call it, a performance specialist or human performance, or just coach in general. Because at the end of the day, we need to be coaches of movement, right? Whether it's moving for long distances, moving under great load, or moving under great speed, we're still teaching context of speed. So when it comes to, you know, the question that you asked about how to teach marching and skipping, the first thing is to really try to get the individual out of their own way, get them out of their own head, and break preconceived notions. So one of the greatest things that I think PTA Global and Scott Hobson and that team do is they really focus on behavior, they focus on developing trust, and they focus on developing kind of a psychological environment within the person's head that allows them to be open. Because when we talk about teaching someone something, there's kind of some steps involved, right? First, they have to actually hear you, right? They need to hear the words that have come out of your mouth, which we know, you know, if you work with kids is difficult enough. Number two, they have to believe and trust you to want to actually do what you have asked. And then let's assume that it's gotten into their head. They believe and trust you. Then the information you actually provided in its literal essence needs to be actually effective at helping them move better, right? So if we break it down like that, it's pretty difficult. And I wrote a tweet last night, which I kind of liked, and it was this, you know, study psychology to learn how to capture your client's attention, and study motor learning to figure out what the heck to do with it once you have it.
Right.
And I think if you look at it from those two lenses, you're going to be a successful teacher. So let's start about making something feel engaging and helping to develop trust. We all know, we're using the example of skipping here. It's a tough thing, not because it inherently is difficult. My four-year-old is skipping down the hall doing things I can't even do, but we just don't do it anymore, right? We've all seen the 1960s, 1950s PE videos floating around Facebook. We don't do that anymore, right? So people just simply, they don't have any exposure. They don't have any context. And from an evolutionary standpoint, when we observe something that is foreign to us, we don't run up and give it a hug. We run the other way. Now, in a literal sense, we don't have lions in the savannah sitting, you know, on our training floors, but we have cognitive lions, right? Saying, I've never done that before. That looks a little awkward. Is there a film crew around? Am I going to be on, you know, the funniest home video show? Like, I can't do that. So we initially have to break down that barrier. We have to engage with trust. So one of the things that I do at the Perform Better session that I think works incredibly well, and I do it with my athletes, when we're coming up on a skip that I think is going to be difficult, I start by level setting. Say, listen, everybody, this is a three-session drill. So already right there, I diffuse this thought process that they have to be perfect at it, right? I say, listen, it's going to take you 2 to 3 sessions. And now that level sets with everybody, which means they're not going to be trying to overthink it, trying to nail it perfect, because that's what they think that I want them to do. At the same time, as a coach, because I told them it's a 3-session drill, I'm not giving them basically nonverbal information that says, come on, why aren't you perfect at this? And we all know as coaches, our heart will start to beat when we see an athlete or a client not performing a movement the way we want to, and we've kind of run out of our cues. So by doing that, we level set, we create a state of trust. The second thing that we do is we use quite a bit of group work and then waterfall work. So the first time we ever have the individuals do the skip or the task, we have them do it in their group of 10 or 12, whatever it might be, right? And after they've done that as a group 2 or 3 times, I'm then going to use a waterfall start. So now we're leveraging observational learning. So now my people on the right, once they've done, you know, 5 yards of skipping, the person to their left goes, and kind of like a typewriter, we go back and forth. And on one rep, we start on the right. And on another rep, we start on the left. So now everybody gets to see the success and the failure of everybody else. And inevitably, the whole thing averaged together to say, wow, you know, some people are better, some people are worse, but we're learning from each of you. And in doing so, what we find is the person that goes at the end is actually the best because they've been able to watch everybody else. It works 100% of the time. And then we flip it around. The other person on the other side that had to go first, they get to watch everybody. So now we diffuse, we create engagement, we create trust. We allow them to be relatable to one another to see, hey, we're all humans. We're all going through this together. They get to observationally learn, which is working at a subconscious level. And now I come in with my cues. Rather than hitting them with these anatomical jargon cues about their hips and their knees and their ankles, I'm coming at it from a storytelling standpoint. And if you've been to one of my sessions, one of the stories I'll tell is, like, okay, we're going to do a skip right now. I want everyone to stand with their feet hip width apart. I actually have them stare down at their feet. And I say, I want you to imagine you have a nice black line around your feet, creating a nice thick circle. And imagine that that circle now fills up with your favorite color. And I'm like, you're back in PE. You're standing on your favorite color circle. This is your home. Stay in the circle all day long. And then when I'm in Chi-Town, I'm like, okay, now I want you to imagine it's cold outside. So zip up your jacket, right? Reminding them to get nice and tall. So now I just say, circle, zip it up. So now the things I'm asking them to focus on are fun. They're simple. They're everyday analogies, everyday external cues. So I never draw their attention to something that could be so complex that they're going to choke on it and not have a good time. We try to get a laugh out of them all the while. And then inevitably, 10 minutes in, they're skipping and they're having a good time. We're seeing them break through. So initially, we get trust, we get engagement, we diffuse anxiety. Anxiety is a very simple definition. It is the gap between where you are and where you want to be, or said otherwise, it is this connection between you identify what you think you can do relative to what is being asked of you. If you think your current capacity is less than what is being asked of you, i.e., I've never done a skip before, you're going to be anxious. And oftentimes when you're anxious, you want to defend yourself. So you're going to avoid giving a full effort. You're going to overthink it, right? You might just get halfway through the repetition and walk it out. I've seen that plenty of times. So we diffuse that. We connect them. We make them feel it's possible. We bring that relatedness piece, and then we give them cues that are purposeful, that are focused, but they're funny, they're engaging, and they relate to things they already know. And pretty soon you got 200 people skipping.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, it's not just the athletes. Like I said, you know, having these, you think like adults, like once they become adults, they wouldn't be so self-conscious about this stuff. But they're like worse than the kids when it comes to this stuff, because they're like, you know, sometimes coming in, they're, you know, overweight, and they're already worried about not being very athletic when they get into this stuff, and it becomes even more of a barrier to get them to do this stuff. But that's awesome.
So Kevin, let me say something about that.
Yeah.
And here's a little trick for the people on the call, on the podcast listening, is when we use what I call coach-controlled drills versus client-controlled, okay? So a coach-controlled drill is if we're doing a tempo drill, that means I'm controlling the tempo. I might say something like switch, switch, and that encourages them to switch on me. Versus I say, okay, I want you to bounce twice on your left leg and then once on your right leg, and I make them control it. Here's what we find. When you're dealing with someone that's an overthinker or doing a skill that they've never done before and you allow them to control it, oftentimes you'll see it can be a train wreck, especially when you're doing variation of marching, skipping, running, on-field type drills. But funny enough, and I do this at Perform Better, when I take control of the drill, and the drill that I'm referring to, if you can just imagine, you're standing on your left leg, for example, your right leg is up as if you were going to do a marching pattern. And when I say go, you start to hop on your left leg. I call it dribbling the basketball. So you're kind of holding this tall kind of running position, bouncing like a ball nice and quickly forward, right? But emphasizing this vertical nature. And then when I say switch, you basically switch your knees and do a high knee drill, but you always come back to your right leg up. So when I do that drill and I'm yelling switch and switch, everybody can do it, no problem at all. But now when I say, okay, bounce two times on your left and then make one switch, one single exchange, coming back to that same position, nobody can do it, right? And it proves to them, I'm like, look, your motor system can do this skill. But when I ask you to take control, if you dial up your consciousness too much, you get in your own way. And I'll tell you what, that is a light bulb for every client, every athlete, every coach. It's a proof point that, look, you actually just did this drill. But now when you think about it, you can't. And it just starts to help individuals, and it just reinforces as coaches. You know, paralysis by analysis requires the athlete to analyze something first, right? And in doing so, what are they analyzing? They're analyzing our words. They're analyzing what we're asking them to focus on. So if we're a more effective communicator, if we use analogies, external cues, and keep our communication brief and focused, we give them less material to choke on in the first place.
Okay, I know. And that was like when I was at those summits, like that was specifically what I was talking about, like just like my jaw dropped when people were actually able to do that stuff. I promise I won't monopolize the whole show. I know we got some questions from the listeners, but I got one more thing I want to talk about real quick. I always do this. I don't even know if you're the perfect person to talk to about this, but I just need to talk to someone about this. Okay. So I'm, you know, I see a lot of stuff. We just had like three summits, so I get a lot of exposure to a lot of people. I, you know, follow a lot of people on Twitter and now Facebook, and now we got Instagram and all this stuff. And I, maybe, I don't know if the audience can back me up. Maybe you can like tweet at me and let me know that you're feeling this way too. But I'm like feeling overwhelmed with positivity, almost to the point where it's like having the reverse effect. It's like, dude, I've had enough positive quotes today. I'm good. I don't need another positive quote. I don't need another picture of the picture of the puppies are fine. The puppies doing really cool stuff. I love that. But just like another like positive thing. And I know this is something like, you know, as people that are trying to better others' lives, like we should be positive. You don't want to train with someone who's like, hey, Nick, how's it going? Nick, I'm down. You know, I know I'm training you today, but I can't believe it. I just had a bad night last night, like the Celtics lost and all that stuff. So I understand that. But maybe the best way I can ask you about this is like when it comes to, you know, working with others and they're doing things wrong, you know, should we still be okay with giving some like negative feedback or some like some coaching cues where we're trying to just let them know that they are doing something wrong, or just any aspect of this whole like weird topic that I have that you want to discuss?
Yeah, no, I think it's, gosh, there's so, like we talked about before the jumping on here, there's so many layers to this, and I definitely have opinions on some of them. Some of them are more valid than others probably, but let's talk about feedback for a second. You know, I think for me, rather than talking about positive feedback versus negative feedback, let's just discuss the best way to give feedback to improve someone's skill, right? Okay. Because at the end of the day, if research said that telling someone you sucked at this, you didn't have enough hip extension, right? Your session today, your effort is horrible. You need to pick yourself up. Come on, what's going on? Mm-hmm. And we just put all this baggage back on them. If research told me that that was the best way to teach someone to learn how to run fast, I'd be a complete jerk during the combine. But the reality is, you know, it doesn't work that way. But similarly, just being ultra positive, right, and overshadowing what the athlete or the client needs to work on just with positive innuendos of great job and high fives and you're killing it today, but not actually putting any substance or responsibility on what the client's supposed to be improving, that's not good either. So I'll give you a really interesting line of research that has pointed to the best way to give feedback. So what they do is they take subjects, okay, and they have them learn a motor skill, so that a skill that they've never done before. So for example, one motor skill when they're initially proving this theory out is they took a bunch of kids who are right-handed and they said, okay, we want you to toss this beanbag with your left hand, okay, and in doing so, toss it at a target, let's say, you know, 10 feet in front of you. But here's what's crazy, Kevin, is they put this screen in front of them, right, so they couldn't even see the target. So it's kind of like, okay, throw this thing at a target you can't see. Now, here's the interesting component of the study. They said, let us know when you want feedback on how accurate you were, right? So obviously that would be pretty important because you can't see it. Right. So you're doing this movement and you're guessing how close you are. So when they analyzed the data, one, they found if you give someone the option to ask for feedback, they actually learn better than someone that does the same amount of reps and gets feedback at the same time, but didn't ask for it in the first place. So that's already an interesting fact. Letting people choose when they get feedback is one way to improve motor learning. And that's been repeated over and over again. But what happened in this study, and they've since shown it, is what do you think, Kevin? Do you think people ask for feedback when they thought they did it right or when they thought they did it wrong?
They always ask if, you know, am I doing this wrong?
Okay. Interesting, right? That's what I thought too. Before I read the conclusion, I'm like, oh, 100%. People are asking for feedback when they think they did it wrong so that that feedback can help them do it right. Well, apparently we were not valuing the inner coach, especially at a subconscious level, nearly enough, because every single one of these studies conclusively have shown when these individuals ask for feedback on an average basis, it's always on their better repetitions. And they've shown this now in adults and kids. So my friend Victor Hall, who works out of our San Diego facility, he calls this, before I ever read this research, we had one of those nights we're talking for like 6 hours, right? Just coaching, catching up. He called it the sippy cup principle. And I love it. I still use that today. And this is what it means. He took his son, right? His son kept, I believe it was his son, was dumping out all the liquid in the sippy cup. And he's like, don't dump it out. So then instead of dumping it out, was the kid, he starts to shake it. Stop shaking it, right? And then he's like, stop. Then he starts to bang it, right? So the kid kept coming up with another way to use it. Now, this kid's too young. I have a daughter. I don't know how, too young to be, you know, vengeful over his father to say, oh, I'm going to get this guy. He's just simply not doing, right, what he's being asked not to do. Fundamentally, what Victor realizes, if I just say, son, when you're done drinking the sippy cup, put it up on the counter, he's only given him one thing. And that one thing is, in fact, what Victor wanted him to do. Mm-hmm. So when we look at this, what do humans want? When humans do it wrong, there's 1,000 other ways that they could do it wrong. But when they've done it right, or at least when they sense they've done it right, that is finite. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. And therefore, when you feel intrinsically that you got it on one of those repetitions, you want that feedback. And that's why I'm always looking for my athletes to turn around after a sprint rep and give me that smile. Like, they already know before they heard from me, they got that smug look like, I nailed that one. Right, I don't even need to look at your clock. I got this. And that's what I call an opportunity to make a mental monster. Mm. At that point, you'll see Coach Nick Winkelman somersault and scream and yell and losing my voice, so that becomes imprinted on that guy's memory, just like the day he has kids or gets married. Right, I want it to be so visually powerful that he'll never forget that technical rep. And I call that a Kool-Aid rep. Drink the Kool-Aid. Mm-hmm. So long story short, here's what we're talking about. It's not that we need to be given hugs all the time and teddy bears. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's smart science and smart coaching to identify what is being done right. Reinforce that one thing with your cueing and your communication, and that's going to continue to build. Versus if we're so focused on telling them what they didn't do right, especially if we do it in a negative tone, we just haven't helped them out. Mm-hmm. We might feel better as the coach because we can pound our chest and say, I saw that error when they were running at 20 miles per hour, but it doesn't help out the athlete.
Gotcha. Like I said, I promise I'd get some of these questions from the listeners, and we actually got some really great questions. Thank you to everyone that submitted stuff. We'll get through a couple of these. So this one is from Roy. Nick, the first time I saw you at the Perform Better Summit, you talked about how coaching an athlete during competition puts stress on them. There's too much stimulus and it is counterproductive. Where can I read more about this topic? And if you wouldn't mind, Nick, just talking a little bit about it in general.
So I think probably the best way to answer that question, not again having full context from it, is we're probably talking about under stress, under competition, there's this possibility of choking and the possibility of the yips. Mm-hmm. So for everyone listening, just so I don't forget, a great book to read more about what happens to movement when we're in competition and under anxiety, especially when movement goes wrong, is a book called Choke. And it's written by Dr. Sian Bilek. S-I-A-N is the first name, B-E-I-L-O-C-K. And Dr. Bilek, she has put forth basically just some of the best research on how choking emerges in sports. So she's looked at golf and a number of other areas. And really what people call this, they call it reinvestment theory is one of them. And if we think about reinvesting, it's basically someone's in competition. They already have the movement learned. It's already automatic, right? Think of a baseball player or an elite running back in the NFL, right? They can read and respond to people around them. But now all of a sudden they're in a slump if it's baseball or they're having a bad day. They're not seeing the hole. The game seems fast to them, right? And they're fundamentally choking. In doing so, the primary theories have pointed to one consistent factor, that oftentimes there'll be a trigger event. Meaning maybe the wind blows and Tiger just barely nicks the ball the wrong way and he misses the putt, a putt that maybe he normally would make 9 out of 10 times. That trigger event has increased the awareness of self and created an anxiety, right? And again, anxiety comes when I feel that there's a difference between what I can do and what is being asked of me. So what does any athlete do when they're having trouble? They start thinking about their movement patterns. They start thinking about how they became elite, and they start focusing on the actual movement itself. So as we talked about earlier in the skipping example, now they're conscious. They're thinking about the movement while they're performing it, which slows down the whole reaction and coordination of the movement. And it goes back to something, Kevin, I said earlier. Paralysis by analysis requires something to be analyzed. So oftentimes when you're dealing with an elite athlete, it takes a sports psychologist to get them out of their own head. But we have an opportunity when we're dealing with youngsters. If we coach them using external cues and analogies, stuff that is not referencing the body or subcomponent techniques like just my shoulder joint, I'm not fueling the mind with any information that could boil to the consciousness under competition and choke them in the first place.
Right.
So long story short, it comes down to how we coach in practice is a big mediating factor and how they're going to express that on the field or on the court or, you know, on the links in the game. And fundamentally, to learn more, one area that you could take is Sion Billick and the book Choke.
Well, let's hit on that topic of training those younger athletes and using more external cues, because, you know, again, that's something that's the big market these days, is that, you know, the kids are getting into the strength and conditioning facility early and earlier. Like now we have 10-year-olds starting up at the gym just because these are kids that are partially being required by their hockey league to now get some off ice training during the week, so they're not playing 48 hockey games a week at 10 years old. So for those of us that are coaching those younger athletes, you know, how could we be coaching them better? I guess what's the best approach to take when it comes to making sure that they are performing these movements as best they can?
Beautiful. Let's start with three books, since that's kind of this theme here.
Perfect. Okay.
First book, Teaching Games for Understanding. TGFU is the acronym. Okay. There's a part one and a part two, Teaching Games for Understanding. Second series of books, Ecological Task Analysis. Ecological is a fancy scientific word for saying, let the environment do the talking and the athlete do the walking.
Okay.
And the third one is constraint-based approaches to skill acquisition. So constraint-based approaches to teaching. So when you're dealing with a 10-year-old, in my opinion, everything should be built around games.
Mm-hmm.
And when you identify the outcome of the game and the movement that needs to be expressed to achieve that outcome, that is what you are teaching them on that one given day.
Mm-hmm.
It is not necessary to provide any kind of cueing or any kind of analogy unless the athlete seems to be struggling with context and intent. But as long as you do a good job saying, here's the instructions, here's the purpose of the game, here's the outcome you are trying to achieve, off you go, have a good time.
Mm-hmm.
Step back and observe movement emerge in response to what you're asking the body to do in the environment. Mm-hmm. That is the whole basis of teaching games for understanding, ecological and constraint-based approaches. Now, if for whatever reason the kid is dense or just not getting it, then come in with an analogy. Mm-hmm. Come in with an external cue. Maybe they need a little bit more one-on-one. They didn't understand your instructions, whatever it might be. They weren't paying attention, you know. But when it comes to teaching, allow them to be much more exploratory in their learning. And that was what this year's presentation for me, Coach Like a Caveman, How the Environment Shapes Our Movement, was all about. There's no better population to apply that teaching method to than to our youth. The problem is once they become adults, they have all their own ideas and expectations.
Right.
And if you don't give them a little instruction or cues, they're going to think you're an incompetent coach,
mm-hmm.
right? So in that case, we have to talk to them a bit more. But inevitably, once we have trust, this approach works equally well with elite individuals.
Yeah, it's fascinating that you said that. And I'm happy because like we kind of have like multiple groups in that age group. Like we have those hockey players where it's literally like they come in for about 45 minutes and it is about like games. It is more about play. We try to do some like, well, I guess you would call it like prehab type stuff to make sure they when they get back on the ice, they don't get injured and stuff like that. But
100%.
No, it's awesome to hear you say all that stuff. And now I got four more books to read, man. Jeez.
Sorry. Well, you know, those are just reference books. Just touch and go, touch and go.
All right. Okay, I know we're running short on time, so I'm gonna get some more of these questions from the audience.
Okay.
This is from Trevor. Trevor
yes.
would like an example of empowering athletes to look inward to find their purpose to nurture intrinsic motivation. example, training sessions letting athlete know purpose/focus and what defines a quote win for that day.
Okay, so here's a book for, I think I saw all three of his questions.
Yes.
So, and they're all three of them are based on this book in this area of science. So the book is called, and I said this on other podcasts, I still haven't seen people posting a lot about this book though, Applying Educational Psychology in Coaching Athletes. Applying Educational Psychology in Coaching Athletes. It's written by Dr. Jeffrey Huber, who is a very, very famous diving coach. I believe he is currently at University of Indiana. I could be wrong, but I believe that's where he's at. So that book covers a lot of different theories. But what is what I was referring to in that, he's referencing a Twitter post that I did. Mm-hmm. You know, it's really key at the end of the day for the individual to know their self-worth, to know their purpose within the broader context of a training session. So, you know, a couple ways that we go about that during the combine process, because it's critical to gain trust and help them engage with the process very early, is I sit down with every single athlete, as you might imagine, one-on-one, once we've done the pre-testing. And in that conversation, once we go through their data, how they stack up to other individuals in their position for the combine, you know, we start talking first about football. Why do you play the game? Mm-hmm. Why do you love the game, right? What kind of makes you tick? What's your it? I ask people this question. If you were to go to the Super Bowl, but nobody was to attend, would you still want to play and win? And some of them say, yes, football is that important for them. Football got them out of a situation and allowed them to see a new life. Other individuals ponder that. They're like, well, if there wasn't the money, there wasn't the fame, you know, I guess I wouldn't be as interested in playing. So I say, why do you play the game? I'm like, what would be the first thing you're going to do if you were to win that Super Bowl? And a lot of them say, I'm going to go give my kids a hug. I'm going to call my mom. I'm going to do this, that, or the other. So inevitably, it's just trying to bring that person to their inner being, their inner reason, their it, as Mark Verstegen likes to call it.
Right.
In terms of then the field, once I know what that it is, I can start pushing my athletes contextually with how I communicate based on what I know is important to them. So I might tie family into an opening speech or a closing speech after a session. I might tie money into a speech at the end of a session. I might tie in the importance of the game and what the game means for the team and how the team is greater than any one individual and how I know that this game has gotten many of you out of a situation and brought you where you are today. So over time, if I'm working with 30 young men, I can tie in their it without calling them out in the context of a speech that is guiding them towards a state of focus that I need them to be in to be successful. Now, back to, I believe, Trevor's question about how we do that in the context of a session. Over the course of the 8 weeks, what I like to tell individuals is we have a weekly focus and then we have a session focus. So for example, week one in the NFL Combine, I tell the guys this minute one when I meet them, this week is all about awareness. I want you to start becoming aware of your body in the context of everything I'm asking you to do. I want you to feel, do you feel light? Do you feel heavy? Do you feel symmetrical? Do you feel good when you run? Does it feel tiring? Do you feel like you have to lumber to get past 10 yards? And once I frame it up in that context, then to make it important, Kevin, I'm asking them questions about those things. So at the end of the first 10-yard sprint on Monday in January for the combine, I'm saying, hey, on that last repetition, did you feel light? Did you feel heavy? Did you feel symmetrical? And Kevin, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to introduce them to their body. I'm trying to introduce that kinesthetic awareness. Mm-hmm. Because once I've introduced them to their body, now in weeks to come where the focus is empowerment, they have the ability to self-correct. You cannot self-correct something that you're not aware of. Therefore, I use awareness as a primary focus, as a weekly focus that week one for that exact purpose. And then within the context of a daily session, we might have a motivational focus, and then we might have a functional focus. So by motivation, it might be just that. Today, gentlemen, I need you to focus in. I need you to remove the girlfriend. I need you to remove the idea of money and draft and cards. I need all that to go away, and I need you to focus on this step today. Mm-hmm. And we might say something fun like the smallest moments in each day lead to the biggest moments in our life. We can't forget to step forward today. And in doing so, I'm going to say, I want you to direct that laser-pointed focus at acceleration. We're learning to get off the line today. And your whole world needs to be separating from that start line like there is a cheetah 2 feet away from you. And now I've primed their motor system, their psychology, that when I talk about push, get out, and purpose, they know exactly what I want from them. And therefore, because that's not necessarily connected to a time, I can make that a win for that day. And then I bring that focus back up in the closing speech, and I might tie it back to a humanistic factor on how focus is not only important in learning to sprint, but also to do well with your money, to treat others with respect, to engage with that GM that might give them a multi-million dollar check and give them their full attention and listen and engage and find a million and one different ways to tie that daily focus back to the humanity.
Man, okay, so I feel like we're just scratching the surface here, but okay, so let's wrap it up with this, and this is another super loaded general question. We have a lot of trainers and coaches that listen to this. Everyone else, I think you might be able to get something from this too. But if you could just have like 5 minutes with all the trainers and all the coaches out there to help them do a better job and be better at what they do, what would you tell them?
Thank you for asking this question. You can read all the books in the world. You can read all the research. But if you don't engage, if you don't make a connection, there's no bridge for that information to be transferred. So for me, the number one thing that I have looked to master over the years and that I would tell all the trainers and coaches listening is to be present. And by to be present, I mean to literally be present in the moment. Don't focus on the proverbial training card in your head. Don't focus on the literal training card that is hanging out of your waistband. Focus on the athlete and the client in front of you and listen and engage with all of your senses. Because what you will find in that rich experience is all the feedback you will need to be an amazing coach. From the subtleties in the facial expression to the change in the body posture, you are going to be getting immediate information on what is working and what is not working. And you're going to pick this information up well before the client or the athlete would even tell you. But unless you are, if you're not present, those aspects you cannot see, you will not pick up. So presence engages them. It drives a resonance that you are purposeful, that you are here, that you are listening. And at the end of the day, most importantly, it allows you to extract the most important information from the people that are most important to you to help them achieve their goals.
Absolutely love it. Love it. Now, before we do go, you can obviously find Nick Winkelman on Twitter. That's pretty much where you can hear from everyone these days, just at Nick Winkelman. But I also want to let people know where they can find some of your music. Because some of the best, the one of the coolest things about you, Nick, and that this is something I respect so much, is that, I think a lot of people in this industry, like, they never like shut it off. Like, it's always strength and conditioning, like 24/7. And for me, it's like doing like dumb nerdy stuff, like going to Japan and playing video games and stuff.
Love it. Yeah.
For you, actually have an amazing DJ setup. And I talked to Chris Poirier. I said, where was Nick with his DJ setup this year? We got to get you on the circuit for next year. But, if people want to find just some of the stuff that you're producing and putting together, would you mind talking a little bit about that and where they can check that stuff out?
Yeah, absolutely. So my DJ handle, and people always ask me this, how to pronounce it, is Mover. And it is spelled M-O-V-E-R-E. And it is Latin, and it is the root word for the words motor, motor learning, movement, and motivation. So it encapsulates who I am and everything we talked about today. To find my music, you can go to soundcloud.com/Mover, again, M-O-V-E-R-E. You can go to mixcloud.com/Mover, and you can follow Mover's Facebook page on Facebook as well. So those are the three major areas. I put anywhere between 1 to 4 mixes up a month, from house to electronic to progressive to tropical, everything that I feel just wakes me up in the morning and gets me moving, which is the purpose of my music alter ego, is to inspire movement through music.
I'm not kidding. Like, I've listened to a bunch of those. Like, whenever you, like, I see them posted on Twitter, like, it, because they run for, like, some of them are, like, 40 minutes long, like, 45 minutes long. Like,
yeah, it's a workout length.
Yeah.
60 minutes, yeah.
Oh, man. Just, like, if you need to get kind of fired up for the day or, you know, you just need a little bit of motivation, like, that's the way to do it. I'll put links for all that stuff in the show notes for the show if people are, you know, driving it and things like that. But definitely give it a look. And like I said, you know, not only respect for everything that you're doing on a coaching side of things, but I think it is super important to, you know, be a little bit, you know, diverse and don't
Absolutely.
Be afraid of doing other stuff and, you know, shaking things up a little bit. But, Nick, anything else that's coming up for you that people should keep an eye out for, just across the board?
No, I mean, the only thing really, you know, you said conference season is over. I'm going to be heading out to Norway to give a presentation in October.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to be speaking at a couple chiropractic events late October in Colorado, as well as in the Royal Chiropractic College, I think as it's called, I think it's in Toronto in Canada in November. And then I'm speaking at a couple, I'm really excited, a couple track and field events later on this year for the MF Athletic, the sister side of Perform Better. So just a couple conferences, and really for me, it's hanging out with the new little guy, the family, and knocking out this dissertation so I can officially put those three very expensive letters behind my name come December. So,
all right. Well, Nick, thank you so much for taking the time. I know, you know, we've been kind of bouncing back and forth. I know you're super, super busy, and I really hope you enjoy a little bit of downtime, just able to relax, get in a couple of those books, enjoy the new member of the family. And for everyone else out there, I forgot to mention this before, but it means a lot if you support the show at patreon.com/thefitcast. It really helps me continue to produce this stuff and make sure it gets out to everyone who cannot support the show. Make sure this stuff stays. It's always going to be free, but it really helps if you think it's worth supporting to jump on there and do it at patreon.com/thefitcast. And of course, if you have iTunes, if you subscribe through there and submit a review, it helps it jump the show up in their algorithmic rankings as well. But man, Nick, thank you so much. It's just such a blast to talk to you for an hour, and you know, we'll definitely have to, of course, catch up down the road.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for all you do.